So the plan for today is first, we just want to make a couple of announcements about what's going to happen in the rest of the program. And then I'll give what I hope will be a relatively concise talk on something we're very excited about, new solutions for dark energy, so to speak. And then, well, the point of this partly is to bring in more theory into this program, which has largely been data driven so far for good reasons, but this is part of the subject, so we want to get there. And so I hope it'll develop into a more general discussion at that point. So the announcement, so let me start at the end. So we're planning a neat event at the end called, which we're calling Geek Fest, which will bring representatives of this amazing list of experiments aiming at this measurement of essential scale ratios. This is some forecast that Dick and his friends have given for how some of them will do, some of the thresholds of the light scale appearing in the plot here, which was really exciting. And these guys, these experimentalists plus expert theorists around at the time will discuss all this and hopefully hash out what the issues are. So that'll be like an intense couple of days during the final week. Looking forward to that. Let's see, and Thursday, the team's going to talk about
effective theory of mathematical structure. National structure calculations and
Okay, great. And Wednesday, I already put something on our schedule because a bunch of people have some interesting contributions. So Scott has something, and maybe some others, so we can have a discussion tomorrow at lunch. And then I guess the last thing I want to say is next week, Dr. Sakia is going to show up, and on Thursday, he'll give us the update on the parameter. Determination looks like in light of some of the questions that have been asked, and that should be very interesting. Okay, any questions about these organizational issues before? Okay, so let me just get started then. So this work that I'm going to discuss is still in progress with Matthew Domelson, who's here, Shigong, and Gonzalez Corona. And it's based on the amazing data that we have, the fact that lambda CVM is correct. And although people get disappointed that it's just lambda CVM, in fact, the lambda part of this and the inflationary part is a huge theoretical challenge. It's something we're still grappling with. We don't have a full framework for it. And, so to me, it's a little bit silly to complain about this. It's a really interesting challenge, even though this lambda part of it could just be the one number. So as everyone knows, it raises big questions about what this framework is, and maybe questions about initial conditions for inflation, which we will return to during the discussion. And as we've discussed, it's also really interesting because just at the model building or phenomenological level, it has some UV sensitivity. So I guess the CC was discovered in 98, and took us a few years to get going on modeling that in string theory. As Theo Meninas likes to complain, string theorists are very anti-considerate.
In which sense?
Every sense.
But starting around 2001, it became tractable to stabilize all the extra degrees of freedom that we get in string theory and start to formulate models, mechanisms for modulating, for stabilizing the extra directions of string theory. And after doing that, it was natural to think about inflation, and that led to this renaissance of mechanisms and a more systematic understanding of the these issues of UV sensitivity on the one hand, and also effective field theory, systematics, and COP searches on the other. So it's been this wonderful interplay. And I have to say, for me, actually, it's kind of embarrassing because all of the forays I made into these connections with signatures and data all originate actually from trying to understand these ridiculous questions here, trying to understand this sort of topography. So I'm coming back to, oh, I can't do this.
Sorry.
Yes.
No. So, so that's my other excuse for talking about this, aside from the fact that it's interesting, is that sometimes these things lead to signatures. But just one last comment, I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why this subject is, has a lot of vitality. It's, you don't know very much ultimately, and that's makes it harder than, for example, particle physics might be. I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's interesting. Okay, so let me start getting to the substance of this. So in the context of string theory, there's been a lot of utility for putting simple solutions of the theory. So these so-called p-grain solutions and their understanding in the microscopic of string theory in terms of p-grains, and certain solutions like the Klein-Rubin solution, where you have geometry sourced by flux, kind of higher dimensional analogs of the electromagnetic field. Simple solutions eventually led to progress in problems involving black hole physics, gauge theory, dualities, famous ADS-CFT, et cetera. And that all that kind of built up from these technical precursors. And I think it's fair to say that in addition to the conceptual issues, the case of the cosmological versions of these questions has been a bit slow because the solutions aren't, at least so far, have not been as simple. I've been accused of, quite rightly, of overstating this in the past. This was around, I don't know, 2007 or something. But in my defense, as Gary Hsu pointed out to me once, in the tech file of this paper, with a long list of ingredients, there was an alternate title.
It's fun to look at tech files.
Yes, yes. Okay. But you know, this idea of finding classical determinant sources to produce considered solutions has stayed around with some, progress both on constraints on it and some solutions, and with an incomplete list of authors here. So what we're dealing with is these extra dimensions of string theory, which descend to four dimensions, giving us various scalar fields. So the famous ones include the dilaton field and famous the log of this coupling of string theory, sizes of extra directions, other things like axions and positions of frames, etc., that you hear about when string theorists talk about inflation, for example. Here's the general structure of a very broad brush. For example, if you just ask what is the potential for the dilaton or for some radial size scalar field, it behaves like a exponential in the canonical normalized field with coefficients that are not particularly small. So coefficients here that are known that are order one in odd units. So in other words, runaway directions which are too slow to go into inflate in themselves. There are also localized defects, these grains and other more exotic objects, which have a similar exponential structure in the canonical field with some localization of the space. And the thing that will concern us with the new solutions today is to take into account to use effects of gravitational redshift or warping in the extra directions. So I'll just list that here in words. And then, of course, there are all sorts of quantum mechanical effects, determinative and non-determinative, that contribute. But for the first step, let me just emphasize this exponential behavior of these contributions. So again, the potential to be off in a runaway from positive value or up to zero from below in limits of decoupling of large radius. And again, I just already said this. And just to be specific, because we'll use this, we know what these alphas and betas are in any particular string compactification that at least is simple enough for us to compute. So for example, if you take the so-called type 2D string theory
and you put it on a five-dimensional sphere, and you compute what these alphas and betas are. Here they are, so there's a contribution to the potential from the curvature of the sphere, which in terms of the canonical field behaves exponentially in this beta. There's flux, there's a kind of five-form kinetic flux in the sphere, which also behaves like an exponential with a different power, things differently on the radius and the Phillips one. And in fact, it turns out that in this solution, both of these things, all of the things that we'll consider, depend only on one linear combination of the dilaton field and the radius of the sphere. So these betas and the alpha of the localized source that we'll be interested in are easily calculable on their own end. So our strategy for finding solutions is very simple. When we start with a kind of what you might call a bottom-up, warm-up example. So start with some theory that lives in five dimensions and take a potential of the form that I just described. So something in bulk in five dimensions that potentially is some new beta phi. In strict theory, we have these sources that I alluded to, and we now say that some of them have positive tension and behave like so-called braids, and others have negative tension, don't move around dynamically, but introduce boundary conditions for fields. For strict theory, this is like F1 prime theory, for example, and there the tension around is negative, and again, it's an exponential shape. So take those and just as bottom-up, warm-up example and put a bulk potential like this and negative tension defects with the exponential being multiplied by the ends of some integral. So in general, this structure would not stabilize the system if you dimensionally reduced and smeared the sources out, but that's not the way to solve the equations here. This is the potential we have in bulk. Let's look for a solution which has a four-dimensional de Sitter symmetry, you know, warp factor in the metric, sitting here, allowing the scalar field, which can't just sit somewhere on the potential, to instead evolve in some spatial direction W. So I'll sometimes call that direction radial, but anyway, it's a spatial direction W, which is the control. And you know, this is very similar to things that were done in the past. It seems that this wasn't quite put together in the past, what we've gathered. So again, we've got this bulk potential and this localized source, which introduces boundary conditions. So here are the equations. We have radial, basically because of the structure of the onslaughts that I've put in. We have this radial direction. This is analogous to an FRW metric, with W being like time and A being like the scale factor. It's not what it is, but the equations are the rotations of that with appropriate sign changes. So you can think of this one as like the radial version of the Friedmann equation, A prime over A squared equals stuff. The sign is completely in place in this equation here, and then for the scalar radial equation. So let me, in fact,
what do you say about stability?
Yeah, so we'll first we'll find the solutions, right? And then we'll get to the what we know about the quadratic stability. But notice that this system, treated naively, you know, the reduction in the warping, we have no solution in the first place. Okay. So long story short, what we'll accomplish today is from this tadpole, we'll find the solution. And in fact, the perturbations we studied are massive, but we haven't studied them all. But even without answering that, the progress is tadpole to solution.
Can I ask some more basic questions, maybe related a little bit?
Yeah.
Is it just wrong to think of O-planes by themselves as objects that are, or should you always think of them in the context of the compactification with all the other ingredients in regards to the stability?
Yeah, they can be produced. That's an important.
It's okay, you don't have to turn it off. You can just turn it off.
Okay, so these are like, I'm just talking about the normal string theory or antifolds. They don't have dynamical collective coordinates. They behave like they have negative tension. They involve a Z2 reflection on the spatial directions. In the microscopic examples, that's what we're talking about. So, for example, just to come back to Steve's point, the simplest example of what I was saying is we'll show an example where alpha and beta are the same here. Okay, so nothing about these ingredients by themselves would remove this runaway tadpole if you treated it naively without the rolling scalar. Let me, in fact, come, since maybe it's most intuitive, especially in this COSMO program, the rotation that I meant to a temporal version would go like this. So the signs flip in such a way that the potential would be negative. Negative curvature spatial slices, and a scalar field that's rolling up and then back down the potential. Okay. Now, as a solution in cosmology, this would have the usual problem of Big Bang and Big Crunch singularities. And in a naive version of what we're doing, rotating this to space, there would also be such singularities. But we have these orientifolds, which stop the evolution before you get to those singularities in a consistent way. So, at the level of this bottom-up thing, it's really as simple as that. These are the equations I just described. The defects impose boundary conditions on the A prime over A at the defect, which is just given by its tension, and also on phi prime, the scalar field is given at the defect by the phi derivative of the tension sigma. And also, to find a simple solution, we insist that the warp factor and the scalar field, which roll up and roll down, do so together, so they come to rest at the same point. So this is four conditions, and we have three integration constants here, plus the parameter WP that I wrote earlier. Just by counting a right to a solution, one finds such solutions. We have them numerically and very recently some analytic examples. It's not always true. There's some regions of parameter space alpha and beta where one can futz with the equations and show that there won't be solutions, some no-go regions. But these, you know, there's some no-go region, which I've written here, but it's easy to avoid that region. Without, you know, having to tune alpha and beta in any particular way. So here's the picture of the solution in real space. It's, although it's not as intuitive, it's bouncing up and down or down and up this potential V from, let me call the region of strongest warping the infrared. So it goes from the infrared to the UV back up to the other infrared. The scalar field is bouncing in this way. So this is the basic shape of these solutions. And again, it's like that crunch bang cosmology where it's non-singular just because we have these orientifolds that prevent a singularity from developing.
I'm sorry, Eva. Yeah. Your metric had a anti-de Sitter slicing, right?
No, a de Sitter slicing.
De Sitter slicing.
I hope I didn't write anti de Sitter.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Could you use some fixed gravity techniques to get analytic solutions to these equations in motion if you allow V to be
dW squared plus stuff? Yeah, we'd like to. I meant to refer to this paper of DeWolf, Karch, et cetera, which did things like, I'm sure there are many papers. We started to look at that. Probably there's room for many ways to look for analytic solutions. So I can't say yes or no right now, but it's a very good. Good idea.
I actually consider that in the paper, and with de Sitter slicing, it's very complicated. With flat slicing, it's easy.
You mean the perturbation study or the?
Oh no, the solutions.
The solutions themselves. Yeah. Okay. There's somebody. Nemanja suggested TOTA theories as a way to find analytic solutions. Basically, another way you can do it is decide that you want A of W to end up simple, and then figure out what V of phi should be to get
it. Right, that's
yeah.
what I was saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that is a very good idea, because we'd like to do as much of this analytically as possible. It's just that we also want to do it microscopically. And we get what we get in string theory. We deal with, you know, specific numbers. There are lots of discrete choices in string theory, so there's, you know, a way to scan over those choices also. But we've found analytic solutions so far by a continuation of some other solution we found in the past, which is not too original, but it's nice to have. And this is another picture of the same thing. It's a couple of warped throats ending at these orientifolds. And also, I should say, in some cases, some of those cases where you don't find a solution, it's basically because the field phi is turning around before the field A has, the field A being the warp factor. So instead of having this, allowing for this Z2 symmetric thing where they both turn around at the same point, you just find in that parameter range that phi just keeps doing this. So in that case, you can stick in a positive tension defect with appropriate boundary conditions to stop the evolution. And it's a little bit more of a kludge, but it works just as well at this level.
The secret you have there, the
yes.
constant does not, it doesn't have, you can find solutions for any,
it does determine the Hubble. In fact, I'll get to a parametrics slightly later, but it's determined.
Just another silly question. The range that you showed for alpha and beta, does that depend on the fact that you're searching for a Z2 symmetric solution, or?
Yes, correct. That no-go region I quoted was for assuming, that's what I meant by no additional structure. It's assisting for that. It's not any kind of deep requirement. It's just because, in fact, we end up also liking the cases with these UV objects. So I already said that what it's familiar, you know, from in cosmology. And here are the explicit numerical solutions, in case you were worried, from the bottom up. One of them has this feature we were just talking about, alpha equals beta equals 3. There's no way that the smeared version of this would have stabilized the system or even given a solution. And other examples are also easy to find. This is what I was saying before. Already said. Yeah, this is going to go quickly. Our motivation is to be able to do this in string theory, where we might have a chance at answering questions like microstate counts for the sitter, et cetera, as well as perhaps developing yet more inflationary mechanisms and so on. This is our first looks at some top-down examples. Ironically, the first ones we found were, as usual, in the supercritical context. So in string theory, there's a potential energy in anything but the critical dimension, which depends on the dilaton in this way, same kind of way, e to the beta phi. That's what's special about the critical dimension, is that this is zero and there's a Minkowski solution. In this case, the fields have to roll around. So we can play our game and make them roll around radially, never getting into strong coupling, and there are orientifolds that can end the solution in the way I've given. Here's what alpha and beta are as a function of dimensionality. A slightly more complicated but critical string example is so-called type 2b string theory, compactified on a sphere, modded out by some group. I already gave you the alphas and betas for this. We do need a UV defect, in this case, as well as orientifolds and a flux contribution to the potential energy. It's a fun example because although most examples in string theory will end up depending on multiple fields, and we'll need to generalize our solutions to that case where multiple fields are rolling up and down, We kind of wanted to start with the simplest cases with just one, and in fact this works because none of these ingredients that are required depend on more than just this combination, in fact. So this is just a couple of random examples. We really expect a zoo of these things. Let me give a little more intuition about this, perhaps, from that last case. So if we had analyzed this in a more crude way, just reducing the sources I gave as if they were all distributed on the extra fifth direction, this is the potential we would have gotten. Turns out the curvature term is subdominant, so we can ignore it. Here's the O3, the defect at the end, the UV brain, and the bulk potential from some flux, with a factor here that corresponds to going to the Einstein frame in four dimensions. So, you know, this is what you get without taking into account the warping. It's not accurate because the warping is important here, but it does give a good estimate of the parametrics of our solution. So I think, well, Matthias was asking about this. This is a case where I can tell you, you know, what the scales are. So basically, there's a length of the interval, which is a modulus, what we've called little l here, the size of the sphere, and basically the Hubble of the lower dimensional system will be of that order. It can be parametrically large, and the string coupling is not independently sourced by these things in this example.
Is the warping near the sources? How does that work? Doesn't that like lead to some divergences?
You know, you work out the equations of motion for the various fields, including these sources, and this is the boundary condition on the warp factor. At this level, it's again like type 1 prime string theory, if you like. It's like the end of the world 8 brain in that, if you move the 8s away from the end. So Steve, of course, asked the next question, which is important. So far, we're just happy because with this essentially trivial to explain technique, we took a tadpole and turned it into a solution, just finally biting the bullet and dealing with warping, which perhaps we should have done before more. Of course, I should say there are warped compactifications, the ones that Steve and Shaman and Joe found in Calabi-Yau manifolds that are already very interesting. The warping here I'm talking about is this extra bit along the interval in these compactifications, where we can just solve the equations. Okay, so obviously one wants to then ask what's happening at second order. Okay, so there's a really nice tool that has been developed. So long story short, we've checked this for the radion mode and it is stable. We're still working it out for the full perturbations of the scalar field. And happily there's a very elegant tool that's been developed, in fact, by Steve and some combination with Mike Douglas. We're using Mike's paper mostly, but it's similar. So first let me talk about the radion. So we take these solutions in higher dimensions and then do a perturbation expansion allowing for a varying scalar field, and the one big D minus one dimensional scalar field that corresponds to the proper size of the extra interval. So the one that solves the constraint, let's call C here, plus delta phi, which is a function both of the distributor coordinate x and the extra coordinate, which I'm now calling z because I'm using conformal coordinates. This is what we used to call w, which is the same direction. So I won't take you through the long calculation of this, but one can take this solution, expand about it, impose the constraints, and obtain an effective action for this C of X. And you find that it's got a positive mass squared. And as I said, we're just still working out delta phi in general. There's this really again, as I keep saying, this nice understanding of how to treat all this in a complete way. So one, again, needs to take deformations which solve the constraint equations rather than making a naive replacement of the fields in the original high-level action. So, you know, one can go through this. And, well, let me just say two things about it. So Douglas, for example, has some general intuition that, you know, the warping will help it. It kind of screens the negative sources. And his paper was sort of about what do you do with the naively, you know, runaway negative direction from the conformal factor. It has to be screened, and the warp factor does do that when you impose the constraints properly. Anyway, he does this analysis, shuffles around the equations, and obtains a compact formula for the effective potential in, let's say, four dimensions, starting from some higher dimensional theory, which can be written in this way I've done here. I'm not explaining this, but I'm just giving you a nice upshot of this hard work that he did. So you can explain it in terms of the energy eigenvalues and wave functions of some analog Schrodinger problem, which has a quantum mechanics potential for, you know, the particle moving in coordinate W with the quantum mechanics potential being this, V of 5W plus phi prime squared of W plus the localized sources, basically how the sources in our stress energy depend on W. That comes in to this potential, this problem. So if you just carry this through and look at our case, you find that the corresponding Schrodinger problem is one where the potential is a sort of quantum mechanics double well potential. And, you know, these variations that we're talking about affect the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues in a way that hopefully will end up being intuitive. So the plan is to, we can do all this more brute force when we're doing it, but I just want to mention that there's this really pretty formalism also for thinking about it. So this is in progress. So, okay, let me summarize. We can take tadpoles of the kind we get from individual sources in string theory, and with a much smaller list of ingredients than before, at least, turn them into consider solutions. So it's somewhat simpler, there's fewer ingredients, and also we can be more explicit about the way the internal field is varying. We're not just reducing in a naive way. We still do need to think about quadratic stability. Actually, we're not proud. All we really want is that if there are tachyonic directions, we're happy if they inflate. We just want to put that condition at least. So that's still in progress, as is a holographic description of this. So one fun thing here is that we have this one warps direction to go from what I keep calling big D, for example, the five-dimensional example, down to four dimensions. That already has some right to a holographic description because there's the strong redshifting on the two sides. And we can start to see what it is. It's some one of these wormhole gauge theories, plus whatever effects the O3 and UV frame add, but it's a pretty small list of things to grapple with, I think. And then, of course, there's the sitter holography in the lower dimensions, which is really one of the goals. So for that, yeah.
About the stability, didn't you say you have numerical solutions, or why?
Yes, so again, the reason I'm talking about it without having done the full quadratic stability yet is that we you know, it's already, to me at least, very interesting that one can take tadpoles and turn them into solutions, you know, whether they're saddle points or not. When I said there are solutions, that's all I meant. These are solutions. They also happen to be stable in the radion direction.
But you couldn't take the stability from the numerical solutions?
Oh, we're in the middle of it. Yeah, we're in the middle of it. I mean, I can show you plots that look really good with a... We have some plots that give us, in fact, a three-term potential that we did not build in. So we really want to understand this better, but... it's in progress. Again, there's some general, very general intuition from St. Mike's paper that warping should help make things stable. So we already see that at the level of finding solutions, and we hope also at the next level. The ones we're solving are, yeah. Okay.
What the boundary condition is also. Basically, it's this boundary condition that is forcing the phi to live high in some place where there's a positive.
Yeah, so you can, I mean, right, you can think about a different, right, that's right. So if we just, if we have no, okay, so I've been focusing on the alphas and betas, but and if I didn't tell you what these were and just kept them order one, you know, then the answer to your previous question would have been everything at the order one, including Hubble. But we do have numbers here that we know that are determined in terms of flux and whatever. So that's where the hierarchies are coming from. They're being put in to those numbers. In this case, it's actually some orbifold projection. But but what is that? What you're asking? Or?
I was wondering why is the boundary condition phi? Why does sigma
point one? Just because the tension, so if A is you know is a gravitational field,
yeah,
it's more
like
after, yeah. So it has a boundary condition. So the reason it has a boundary condition at this localized source is because there's a square root of the term in that
direction. Yeah, but what
about for phi? Well, so also for phi. So in other words, this term really depends both on A and on phi. So phi double prime equals the derivative of this one vector by A double prime equals. Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe you addressed this and I missed it, but you have solutions with a hierarchy of scale, so the difference between the distance between your orientable planes is small compared to the Hubble scale, for example.
Well, actually, we do think we have that, but we're not engineering something where the other directions are small compared to the Hubble scale.
Other than the five that you're talking about.
The five are the ones that I'm saying I don't think will end up smaller, you know, according to just what we've done here. This is not aimed right now at phenomenology.
Right.
It's more aimed at simplicity for holographic reasons, perhaps, than at phenomenology. But one could then try and go further. Yeah. I mean, this kind of structure, of course, comes up not just in these kinds of backgrounds which are as close to Freud as you can get, but one could also consider, you know, if you instead consider a torus, then you can make it whatever size you want, or a Calabi-Yau, or you know, other manifolds. You can start to play with this. Very generally, it's just we were starting with the simplest thing. So long story short,
right.
We didn't engineer a hierarchy between all the internal dimensions.
The only thing with dimension on size that you have is the length.
There's a length, in the bottom-up model, that's the only thing about the bottom-up model. In the bottom-up model, yes, there's only that.
So the only way to get the Hubble much bigger is in one of these exponentials because of the warping.
Yeah, that's completely right.
The solution was not particular.
The solution in the numerics was not putting in any, I mean, we've actually added by hand control factors in those solutions as well, but when it comes to the microscopic models, we want to know if we have numbers we can dial discreetly, and in that context, we do happen to. I think I had it somewhere. I mean, again, in a semi-random example, L is the size of the interval, R is the size of the sphere. You know, we can get this hierarchy if we want. NC is some flux number, it's an integer, and F is also an integer, K is an integer.
But they can be arbitrarily large or eventually.
It's on the basis that they can be arbitrarily large. Yeah.
I don't remember. Is this somehow related to this work by Cliff Burgess and Fernando Quevedo, where they do, I think, 6D gravity and compactify on some kind of sphere or something?
No, I took a quick look at those papers, and I don't think they have the same bulk stuff that we have. I think, I forget exactly what they did. I'll look more literature, but often people wrote papers where they did some subset of this, but not.
Yeah.
Often, you know, often in, obviously in the RS literature, it was hard topological constant of either sign, which is not, you know, of interest from this point of view. I mean, it's interesting, but it's not enough. There was a paper by Real and Chamblin, which kind of even had their same notation with alpha and beta and did something, but they didn't quite do it. I mean, so I know what you're saying. There's a lot of good work in this direction, but yeah. I mean, if they had done this, they would have naturally wanted to make it more microscopic, and it would have been easy.
No, I don't think they embedded it ever in string theory or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, if you just start from that point of view, you know, you're led to this without having to think too hard because of, you're stuck with it. You're stuck with this structure of these alpha and betas of order one and so on. So, yeah.
On the dwarf side, your couplings now are time dependent.
Well, I agree with that statement, but for later reasons. Sorry, why are you saying that
I'm
here?
I'm just wondering if you're also looking at non-adiabatic effects coming, for example, of this.
So the dual lives on De Sitter, yeah. But you could work, if you like, with a static metric on De Sitter. De Sitter does eventually decay, and then the dual is probably time-dependent. But as it, before it decays, it's just the same. Any more? Okay, so I wanted to start the discussion of theoretical issues with equations, and so that was that. But now maybe we can start the discussion. So there are lots of questions in this area. Basically, we don't know what the framework is for studying, if we want to, cosmology from start to finish. I mean, you don't know how to understand probabilities and what happens to the universe to focus on, etc. Here I've put up my usual point of view on that, which involves conservatively working in an observer patch and considering the Randall Sundin-like duality that you get from that. There are other ideas. Hopefully some of you will say what yours are. One question one might ask, which is kind of related to what Andreas and Matthias and I were discussing at lunch the other day, is, you know, one might hope that finding the framework, or a consistent framework in this context, would then answer questions like, how do we think about initial conditions for inflation? Which, so far, all that happens is everyone kind of shares their feelings about that. Probably to share your feelings. But it's a very interesting question, but you know, it need not have an interesting answer, also as we discussed yesterday. If the world were ADS, it's not, but if it were, you know, somebody living in ADS who asked, you know, what are the initial conditions and why, and you know, there would be no answer to that. This framework there is normal quantum field theory. You evolve from, you have to specify the initial state, and then you can evolve to the future, but there is no, you know, preferred initial state. We just don't know in this case. Maybe it's different enough that it could be, right? So that's one of the issues. The other issue is just, you know, what is the best way to work up to an understanding of the framework? Or if you have a better idea of what, you know, this fits also into the question of just, when people talk about the mysteries of dark energy, what do they really mean? This is what I mean by that, but cosmologists tend to mean, can I modify gravity and, you know, but here we have other problems. So let me just leave it at that and hope for some discussion. Or you can ask further questions about oriental folds. It's your choice. Or we can just go work.
So
Is the general thinking that you should address these questions in the framework of de Sitter, because when you go to high energy, you have an approximate de Sitter symmetry? When we know, for example, that inflation is not, strictly speaking, we break time translation invariance, of course. And
yeah, I mean, there are two things. There's the latency C, which, you know, may dominate soon and for an exponentially long time, according to the landscape theory, which may or may not be correct. But there's that, you know, place where de Sitter matters. In inflation, it's just an approximation. Yeah, so I mean, I can say a little bit more about that. I mean, in this framework, one can, for example, study the holographic renormalization groups of the way that the dual RG looks in this geometry, and you find, interestingly, that the decay of the sitter corresponds to very tiny but non-zero imaginary terms. So, you know, the theory knows that it's incomplete. So in this way of organizing things, you get the sitter for finite period, and its entropy is finite, its Planck mass is finite in the dual, but these issues go away in the deep asymptotic future, so that's our hope.
So can I map my reasoning that small complex bit is sort of the statement of the initial condition problem, of why is it a small complex bit?
Well, okay, yeah, I mean, if it's too much like ADS-CFT, the answer will be there is no preferred state. I mean, that's the thing. So I don't know. Maybe someone else knows.
So maybe I'm just trying to understand better. So are you saying maybe hidden in this formalism is a selection of a state? You're sort of saying maybe yes.
I'm saying very little. I'm saying we don't know the framework, and because we don't know it, there's a chance that it will eventually answer that question. But I'm also saying we already have a what we think is a complete theory of quantum gravity for which that question has a
And that's very normal,
answer.
But that's like a totally normal thing for physical laws.
Sure.
You don't have to go all the way.
It's still there, yeah.
I mean, there is a clear difference, right? You sort of make the case that there might be a preferred state.
Okay, good.
Right? And I mean, I think from the beginning, people understood that quantum gravity would be very sensitive to asymptotic boundary conditions. And people talked about quantum gravity for asymptotically flat space times. You know, just the fact that the Hamiltonian, you know, is a constraint, if you, you know, keep your last function going to zero, but if you let it go to a constant, you march up an asymptotic time, and then we believe we have actual Hamiltonian energies and stuff. So in ADS, it's like asymptotically flat. You have a clear asymptotic region, and you have a boundary there, which we now understand gives you an ordinary field theory as a dual and no preferred state. But de Sitter doesn't have a boundary, right? So if you're looking for quantum theory of de Sitter or positive cosmological constant.
No, I totally agree. That's why it's different enough.
It's much more like a compact universe. That could well have a
it is different in that way. Yeah. But how you go from that to the state should be unique is still a big leap.
Well, that doesn't tell you what is the preferred state.
But why does it tell you that there is one?
It doesn't tell you there has to be one, but there are these interesting ideas like Hartle and Hawking and others which...
Okay, good. So I think we should just sort of discuss it, because it's too bad that...
That Hartle and Hawking aren't here. No.
but Norris Thomas. But he'll have his chance. He's had... So take a Hartle Hawking state, add a particle to it. I don't believe that that's not preferred. I mean, I don't believe that that's impossible. Or rather, no one has shown that that's impossible. So, I mean,
So what's so preferred about Hartle-Hawking?
It's just an assumption. It's not. I don't see. It's a very nice, elegant preferred assumption, but there's nothing.
It's an assumption clearly, but it is a sort of aesthetically pleasing assumption because
yes.
it's the simplest.
So, but then that's different when you say a state is preferred. It sounds like you're going to bring out some great math machinery that's going to.
Right,
well,
to eliminate other ones. Right, and so in ADS.
You can say it's a nice, attractive assumption. That sounds much weaker.
I mean, so in ADS, the vacuum is, special in some sense. It has more symmetry in it, but it's definitely not the only state you could have, and it would be wrong in this quantum gravity theory from our observers in that theory, and declare that it had to be vacuum state because we like it. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be...
But let me throw out a chain of reasoning that involves the word preferred and gets to the conclusion that there is something preferred in this.
Okay, okay.
And it starts with your ADS CFTism. Uh-huh. Suppose we know that an ADS space with some more or less definite energy E, then we actually believe that in some coarse grained sense, there is a preferred state. But the thing which in the bulk is the ADS Schwarzschild black hole. And we believe that, you know, almost all field theory states at a moderately coarse grained level will behave like that.
So large entropy.
Yeah, it's the usual statement that...
Okay, so why was inflation happening at such small entropy?
But, yeah, that's the trouble.
Why aren't we in...
Well, that's a question of figuring out what the
thermodynamic
system is. And
no, there's a notion of equilibrium, certainly.
Is that?
There is a notion of equilibrium.
But the universe is not in it.
We wouldn't have a second law.
So just to be provocative, how do you know until we understand better what the de Sitter entropy is or the equivalent?
I do try that, by the way. You really have to stand on your head to deal with the fact that everything you see is not equilibrium at all. So you have to imagine something out, almost totally decoupled. That's my favorite thing to try. But it leads to assumptions that
I certainly don't know how to make a picture of it being in equilibrium. But you could say similar words, and if you take Gary's comment as just saying that fixes the energy of the space-time to be zero, then you might say the right analog is ADS CFT at some fixed energy, in which case there is a preferred state, although I agree it has these unpleasant properties that's all in equilibrium.
Yeah, I find that an exciting challenge. I don't want to just,
But Don, you don't so much have a preferred state as a preferred set of properties of a whole lot of states.
I'm even happy with those words. I said this involved the word prefer.
But it seems to me there's a profound question, which is, you know, is there something beyond the laws of usual quantum mechanics that will pick out a particular state or set of states, as opposed to some ordinary quantum system where there's a whole bunch of states and any one of them and any linear combination is a legitimate state.
Exactly.
So if you're willing to give up your imaginary piece, which is something I try to do, then you have a...
which imaginary piece?
The decay of the center space, then you have then lambda sets the temperature. Lambda sort of thing sets the temperature, and you can imagine that's your equilibrium. But then you have to imagine weird stuff to get cosmology out of that. But it's, it is, so then I think it is like everything, you know, all of physics is in this equilibrium, participating in this equilibrium. So in that sense, it's, I think it's what Mark was saying. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it's sort of one state, it's one thermal state.
I think he was sort of saying the opposite, which is he's asking if there's something beyond just saying it's like a normal quantum system, which happens to be, have evolved into equilibrium.
But I think the key is that it's finite.
It's not that we can't find an excuse to believe in a preferred set of properties for the state. We don't like the conclusion.
No, it's just that we don't, to me it's that we don't know. We don't know the framework. In this case, you know, we don't have the same statement that it's just a field theory.
Yeah, maybe I'll push a little harder to say, I think this possibility is tied with the system being finite. And I think that's when it can be ergodic and explore, and the ideal initial conditions is kind of vague because you just start at some random part of the cycle and then you come back. But none of the modern thinking in this room likes finite, they're truly finite theories.
Well, again, you could have a finite...
Temporarily finite theory or something.
Well, okay. I mean, you could have a finite ordinary quantum system if you wanted.
Oh, yeah, it's out of the hat, but it's not...
So we can separate that
really
issue from the...
It's not really string theory, it's not really...
Well, okay, let me say one more thing. This is, in this context, I don't know if this was at all clear, but there's this warp metric on the Sitter which gives us this macroscopic understanding of the Sitter as two warp throats which are coupled to each other into gravity. Okay, so that's just, it's like Randall-Sundrum theory, and it's like the infrared part of ABS-CFT. Okay, that's what the center by itself is in the static patch. And if you take the string theory potential that gives you the corresponding solutions, you find that the way that the potential goes to zero at weak coupling and large radius, the thing I said, just at a technical level earlier, so this feature here comes directly into so there's this microscopic brain construction that reproduces this structure precisely because of the fact that the potential goes to zero and has this kind of shape. It would not have worked otherwise. It would not have worked if there was a hard cosmological constant with no decay. I'm not explaining this. I'd be happy to offline sometime. But it's, I'm saying there's some.
I'm saying we
try to work on this in some detail, and there are. So I'm saying that there are some, you know, on the face of it, just sort of little technical facts, but qualitative facts about the structure of solutions, which you know, can be compared to sort of macroscopic ideas about homography, and there are some places where they agree in a way that depends on the metastability.
So that's why it's hard to, that's what you're up against if you want to find a system is arguing.
I'm fully down with people exploring different possibilities,
in my intuition right now is that it's either a finite system and you can play these equilibrium games, or if it's not, I think you're stuck with never explaining it.
You keep saying equilibrium, but I mean, one of the key things we know about the initial state was that it was a low entropy state.
So that would have to be fluctuating. So if you want control over initial conditions, the only physics I know that really controls them is equilibrium, where you don't have initial conditions, you have fluctuations. You have a system sitting there fluctuating.
Penrose argued long ago, right? That if we were in some sense in equilibrium, the second law you say would happen only because of some fluctuation. But that, I mean, I think people have having people argue that that would lead to all sorts of bizarre physics that,
I'm just saying that's the only system I know that rids itself of initial conditions is just assumptions. That's the only model I have in my head of how I can walk away from physics where I'm just putting stuff in by hand at the beginning. And that's fine. Like, you walk the halls of a physics department, it's only the cosmologists that are even worried about this, right? Mostly it's good physics to have some equations that do the job for you, and then you choose whatever conditions you need to talk about the experiment you're doing or the universe you're observing or whatever. And that's considered, you know, great physics. So it's just Alan Guth wrote this paper, you know, 30 years ago or whatever, that got everyone excited that we were going to dynamically explain initial conditions. And, you know, it's been a fun ride. But I don't know if it's. I'd love just to see a toy model where the initial conditions were somehow controlled. And thermal equilibrium is the only one I know, and it does. So I have sort of hand wavy things I do about the Boltzmann rings and so on, but I admit they're hand waving, and I admit they're not, supported by good technology at this point. It may simply not work. And I think I'm curious about it.
For me, a simple assumption like the Hartle-Hawking. Assumption. I mean, it's simple, it's easy to state, it has, you know, a certain aesthetic appeal. If that were shown to reproduce observations, I would be happy, if all the other things were not ruled out.
Yeah, you'd be in great company. That's what physicists do.
Okay, so you make simple assumptions and hope that they reproduce lots of phenomena.
But it's different than the Guth agenda that was set.
Well, I'm not saying that that's the only possible state. I'm just saying that it's a...
You're saying you would have... feel like you could infer that it was the correct state from some
Well, we do that among theories all the time. If you have two competing theories, you'll simple one.
Are we being practical, or are we?
I've seen, since we don't know, as you say, whether the true quantum theory of gravity has a unique state built in, or whether it's like the rest of physics where you have lots of states and you pick one.
I'm just saying, suppose that Thomas comes and says, actually, the Hartle-Hawking wave function predicts, you know, this very specific model of inflation with, you know, and some smoking gun signature that is seen. That's the kind of thing you have in mind? Or you have in mind something where it's kind of consistent, but, you know, hasn't been ruled out?
Yeah, just for that it works. Yeah, just the second one.
But then why are you happy?
Yeah. But maybe the conditions are a joke.
Well, okay, but that's not making any
problems. No, they're not something we can deeply, profoundly state about.
In other words, you don't have in mind sort of detailed evidence, any kind of detailed evidence for this idea.
So it's a nice way to wash our hands of it.
one point with gravity that makes it different is that you want to solve something like the equation H equals zero, which is great equation. And we don't really understand what the solutions of that in the quantum theory look like. We have approximate descriptions of them in the semi-classical regime, and there are a lot of them in the semi-classical regime, but it may well be that that's where the different nature of the specification of the states is revealed, is what we ultimately understand.
I totally agree. I mean, you know,
where we solve, or how we solve that equation in an exact quantum theory.
Yeah, I mean,
that's different.
I mean, another way to say that is any way anybody has tried to do a holographic description of the center, including the, you know, the much more famous DSDFT, has this issue in it. It has gravity in it left over. If you keep to just the center and don't let it decay. And so that goes along with your point, but sorry.
So are you sort of saying what it could do is choose one state?
Maybe. Period. I don't know. We don't know.
That is the other alternative.
Right? So I think part of the point is, you know, you say the only thing I know which is good at specifying unique states is, say, what I don't know, finite system or whatever. But I think, you know, an important point is that gravity does have this difference, which we have not properly understood yet. This different structure.
Yeah, I'm just checking. You're putting forward a model where maybe the math does deliver the one state.
But is that true? So Steve,
I'm just raising, like, you know, so it's in the spirit of.
Wait, take world sheet string theory as an example of a theory of gravity that we.
Yeah.
In that case, it's just not true, right? You can have.
There you have four states.
You have lots of states.
Yeah.
These are the particles of string theory.
Yeah, but there's something much more non-trivial about higher dimensional gravity.
But the Hamiltonian constraint is in there. I mean.
Yeah. So that's an example of where you can solve something like Hamiltonian.
And it doesn't. Yeah.
And it doesn't give you the magic you need. But
right. Higher dimensional gravity is lower dimensional gravity. I actually, I think this boils down to the Hamiltonian constraint, basically. You can keep iterating holography down to that. And the world sheet example gives me a lot of pause. I think it might be. I could be wrong, but I think Andy has a good question to ask everybody. Is there even a toy model of something? Where
this kind of gravity.
Or some kind of magic. Some other kind of, some other way of thinking that I really am in control of it.
Is there an argument that supposedly could be and would be not?
No, but it's just an observation that gravity has this feature that we don't, which we don't understand. It's true we understand the physics of out. We understand this kind of problem in very simple toy models, maybe oversimplified.
What part don't we understand? In any sense different than, you know, we don't know how to solve H equals E in QCD?
I think it's very different. We don't know the space of states and all the gravity. To point to concrete evidence for this, look at all the debates we have about all kinds of wild things.
Well, so I wasn't going to bring this up yet, but maybe I shouldn't. But
no, we shouldn't.
You have no standing in this debate. I mean, I thought one of these guys was going to, or you was going to, so I thought the all these discussions about black holes going on, so the interior of the black hole is supposed to be a place where you don't have all the naive states that you might have thought. It can't all be produced. The black hole is, you know, this geometry within it, inside of the horizon. It's a patch of space that wasn't there before the black hole formed, and may not be somewhat later afterwards. We don't know. Some people know. But
well, we don't know which one.
But is that an example, actually, where there's a...
Well, that is an example. Yeah, I didn't want to say the word black holes, it's cosmology.
Well,
so it's absolutely true that there are at least a lot of parallels between the two, where the question is, you know, really different than the same. But in the black hole case, you know, we do have a large reaction, as compared to at least the naive number of the people states.
No, we don't really know that. We know
what the naive field theory counting is, the number of internal states.
Sorry, but this is just understanding. So this is a claim that there are less states that you might count otherwise, but never getting to one.
No, nothing. It's sort of like if you look at this patch of the inside of the black hole, and you could have modes moving in both directions. Can you create them all just by matter or infalling, you know, observers?
Maybe there are some constraints, but there's many possible.
You can't do everything you might naively think.
This is a little facetious, but there is getting something that gets to one. By the time the black hole evaporates, the interior has to get down to one state. That's kind of a magic thing.
But the exterior has to have high entropies.
Not at all.
Right, okay, good. So maybe that's a hint.
That was a little bit of a facetious thing. But there are things that we really don't understand there, how they properly.
Yeah, I mean, I think in other ways.
Yeah, it's because you said the interior, but the whole thing can be in a lot of states. Still, you're just like saying, any quantum system, and then tangling with something else, eventually.
Well, again, to be this is very oversimplified, probably wrong, but you know, from the point of view of the interior of the black hole, you have to get down to one state by the time the black hole is evaporated. You know, if you think of sailing into
something,
singularity. Yeah. So flip it upside down and turn it into a cosmology.
But in one state, is it always this? I don't know how to make this
question.
Is it always the same state?
It's not obvious, it's always the same state.
Yeah, is it always the same state? Right. It's just at some point there is something about this. So even if you say the interior, then you map it into a cosmology. Is this good enough? Because
you want to could you get all these different
Depending on the exterior.
Well, I thought that's what you'd say the answer was no, Jim. You can't create anything. Corresponding to a right moving mode inside.
Well, you certainly, that's a state that's not supposed to have any information about the initial state.
Anyway, we don't have, I mean.
You've got to have all of the information come back out and off the radiation.
Yes, if you form these white lines. But, you know, this cosmology discussion seems to be more analogous to talking about black holes that might not have formed from collapse.
In fact,
it's a different discussion, at least in principle. Well,
the analogies generally aren't that good. I mean, inflation is a big part of the cosmological case, and it's nowhere in the black hole case. It's not the same kind of cosmology in very important ways.
Doesn't play an important role in this part of the.
It could be that here it's inflation that's giving us the horizons, and there it's formation of black holes giving horizons, and that's enough of an analogy. But the cosmology, quote unquote, that's inside the black hole is not anything close to this cosmology.
Yeah, it's
very importantly different. So one shouldn't push the analogies too much. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what you had in mind, Don, but I resonated with that comment because there's. Well, if you do ADS-CFT with the dual on the sitter, you can break the field theory up into non-overlapping static patches, and it's sort of like an internal black hole, and then it has these two sectors. It's dual to, you know, ABS as usual, but you can break that up into patches, which have analogs of the patches that I talked about in the internal black hole. So I wanted to ask you more about that sometime, in fact. I don't know if that's what you had in mind here, but it could bring us back to this.
That's a fine example of what I had in mind.
Okay. I mean, my hope is we build up to, I mean, the reason, aside from the fact that we're excited about these solutions that I talked about them first, is, again, back here, you know, people could have come up with ADS CFT by just thinking macroscopically and saying, there's the symmetry, and could have written down the dictionary at that level. But that is not how it happened. People did not do it. That doesn't mean it won't happen in the Cosmo or black hole case, but it didn't happen. Instead, it was partly just, you know, understanding the microscopic quantum gravity issues, the solutions, et cetera, building up to it. So I don't think we should jump to conclusions. We might be led, even more ready to be led to the right conclusions if we just build up to the answer, is my personal view. However, the discussions are fun, so I didn't mean to. How do we do? I guess it's about the right time, unless any more solutions.
Solution.
So I call this session solutions and problems, which is pretty much like. Right. Anything else? Okay.